Support for NHPR's The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire 2nd District Congresswoman Anne McLean Custer is with us today. We'll hear her views on key legislation on Capitol Hill with impacts on the Granite State. That includes where dollars from the recent pandemic economic relief bill will be spent, how the U.S. House might weigh the president's new infrastructure proposal, and what the details are of two gun background check bills passed recently in the wake of more mass shootings. As always, we welcome your questions too. Send them in by email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can call 800-892-6477. And Representative Custer, welcome back. Thanks for the time.
Laura, great to be with you. Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's talk about those gun bills first that I just mentioned. And as you know, Congresswoman, these mass shootings just keep occurring. Atlanta, Colorado, just yesterday, California. You guys in the House passed two gun bills in March. If I could just summarize, one would require background checks for all gun purchases. The other would extend the time the FBI has to vet those who are flagged by the National Instant Background Check System. Some iteration of these current bills have been up for debate before many, many, many times. What are the chances, Congresswoman, that these latest versions will be any more successful?
Well, Laura, I think this is where the American people come in. More than 90% of Americans support these expanded background checks for all gun sales. And the one about giving the FBI time, what we found was that the cases that took longer for the FBI to investigate are usually the most troublesome cases. And there was a presumption that if the FBI didn't finish the investigation in a short period of time, the presumption was the person could buy the gun. Now we've given them 10 days, which will give them more time. I think the American people want this, Laura. They've been begging for this, and it's just been the Republican senators that have blocked this legislation from coming to the floor. Now, Senator Schumer, the president of the Senate, has said he will bring the gun bills to the floor. And I think the American people will speak with one voice, get this done.
You said 90% of Americans support these background checks. And I've heard Democrats use that statistic before. But where does that come from, Congresswoman? It seems like 90% would mean these would have passed a long time ago.
They would have, but for the strength of the NRA with Republican politicians. And that is what's wrong with not only what's wrong with the U.S. Senate, but what's wrong with the Republican Party at this point. It doesn't speak for the American people. And if you talk to any responsible gun owner here in New Hampshire, I meet with hunters, I meet with sportsmen, I meet with people who want to protect themselves in their home. They all believe in these background checks that will root out people with unstable backgrounds that could be a danger to their family. And I think that's the point of this. It's gone too far. We're talking about, you know, movie theaters, elementary schools, churches, grocery stores. We're not safe in our own communities in many parts of this country because of gun violence. And so I have colleagues that have dealt with these mass shootings in their districts. I have colleagues that go home to shootings in their districts every weekend in the big cities. And we've got to make sure that we can keep our constituents safe. And so the pressure is on in the Senate to pass these bills, and I think they will pass. I think this is a unique opportunity, but everyone needs to speak up.
Well, in voting for these bills in the House, and again, as you said, they're on their way to the Senate now, you said you are a, quote, strong supporter of the Second Amendment. What does that mean, Congresswoman, being a strong supporter of the Second Amendment? Where do you draw the line on government control when it comes to guns?
Well, what I'm talking about is where New Hampshire voters are. My there's a long history, a tradition, if you will, of hunting and fishing and sportsmanship here in New Hampshire. And I've learned quite a bit myself in recent years about people, including women, who want to protect themselves personally in their home. So I am not about taking the guns away from people, but I am about these background checks, and I have signed on to the weapons of war prohibition. I don't believe that hunters or people protecting themselves in their home need automatic weapons that are weapons of war now being sold. And when we hear about these mass shootings, that's typically the type of weapon that's being used.
You mentioned, women seeking to protect themselves. Is it possible that either of these background check bills would slow down the process for a woman who might be in a scary domestic situation?
No, not if she passes the background check quickly. As soon as she is approved, she can purchase the gun, and that typically happens in 2 to 3 days. What I was talking about is there was a presumption that the person could purchase the gun if the background check was not completed. And what we found was that it's the more complex situations, people with a criminal background, people with other gun violence incidents that take longer. And so the presumption should be the other way around. We should give the FBI plenty of time to check these out.
We talked earlier about how, again, these bills have not gone through before, even though they've been raised many, many times. Are these current iterations of background checks, are they crafted any differently, Congresswoman, so they might appeal to more gun rights supporters on Capitol Hill, in the Senate specifically?
Well, they passed overwhelmingly in the House, and we had Republican support. So I anticipate that they will pass in the Senate, and that there will be Republican support.
I want to ask you, Congresswoman, about the January 6th insurrection on the U.S. Capitol. Hard to believe it's been almost 3 months, and many of your colleagues have renewed calls for new legislation to formally criminalize domestic terrorism. But then on Capitol Hill, you've also heard from civil liberties groups who say that a domestic counterterrorism law could undermine our First Amendment rights, could be used to target people of color and other marginalized communities. What do you think about this, Congresswoman? Do you agree with the idea of formally criminalizing, quote unquote, domestic terrorism, putting that down in statute?
Well, I think what we need to do is have a much more robust presence within the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, our civil police enforcement for people who threaten our country from within. And I think what happened was during the 4 years of the Trump administration, there were not prosecutions about threats against our government, and there were not investigations and intelligence being gathered. They were tended to have a blind eye toward domestic terrorists that were threatening our country from within, particularly white supremacists and people who believed that they wanted to overthrow the government when they felt that Donald Trump lost the election and they wished he hadn't, I guess is the best way to put it. So what we're looking at now, it is a fine balance. Obviously, I support the First Amendment right to petition the government and to speak freely about your grievances with the government. But what we saw on January 6th was a different thing entirely. This was seditious conduct. This was conduct attempting to interfere with the lawful democracy. And at its most critical point, it was very, very symbolic. I mean, they chose January 6th for a reason and organized around that for many weeks. The president was inviting people to Washington weeks before, saying they use this expression, stop the steal. They wanted to interfere with the process that Congress carries out to reaffirm the lawful election in November. And we were there to witness that, to participate in that process. And, you know, the American people saw the government
being overrun. Sure, and we all remember that day. I guess the question is, so now what? Do you, as some of your colleagues say, need new laws? Or are you saying that, you know, strengthening current security and surveillance is enough to prevent these, you know, these types of incidents?
Yeah, and I think that's what we'll be debating. We'll be having hearings to hear about what the Department of Justice now, under our Attorney General Merrick Garland, what they are finding are threats to our society, to our country, to civil, you know, just the community functioning. But I have not taken a position one way or the other on whether, you know, where we go from here. I believe that we do have laws in place about these types of threats, and they should be investigated. And as necessary, if criminal acts occur, then people should be held accountable. And that's what's happening right now. You'll see the FBI all across the country investigating these cases. The cases are now coming through the courts, and many of them are very, very serious charges. 140 police were injured seriously. One died that day, two died afterward. People, one lost an eye, one lost three fingers. So, I mean, these types of threats need to be taken very seriously.
Well, speaking of the process rolling out, as you said, and people involved being held accountable, according to NPR, nearly 20% of people charged in the attack on the Capitol had either served in the military or were currently serving. That compares to just 7% of the population overall. Some of your Democratic colleagues in Congress are asking the Biden administration to screen service members' social media accounts for ties to radical movements. What do you think about that, Congresswoman?
I do think we have a problem in the military, and in fact, in many police departments, for these ties to radical beliefs and actions. So I do think that it's relevant in a background check for police or military to understand, is this a person, not that has a grievance, peaceful disagreement with the government. I'm not concerned about that. What I'm concerned about is that there were current and former members of our military who were trained for combat against our enemies, who were using that training in combat against our government.
So what's the approach there, or the solution there, or the step that Congress should take?
I think they're working on that right now. My understanding is the Pentagon is going through a review of being much more attentive. And again, Laura, it's tied into this blind eye from the Trump administration about white supremacists, about violence toward the government, toward communities, toward particular groups of people. You had these different groups that were organized online. And now we're looking back, and it was very obvious what they were planning in terms of trying to overthrow the government. But the reason that that was not identified was because that element of the Trump Department of Justice, the FBI, had not been either funded or approved to find this information out. I think we need to know. And keep in mind, this is also impacting state capitals. You'll remember the threats against the governor of Michigan and the state house in Michigan that was overthrown, taken over by violent protesters and radicalized protesters. So I think we had signals that this was going on. And what the Biden administration is going to do is take this very, very seriously, both at the Pentagon, at the Department of Justice, and throughout our government.
I want to remind listeners that we are talking with New Hampshire Democratic Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer today, and we'd love to hear from you. We're taking your questions and comments throughout the hour at exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can give us a call, 800-892-6477. Congresswoman, let's turn to the pandemic and some economic relief measures related to it. There's been a lot going on. But first, just the pandemic itself, please. The director of the CDC just recently made an emotional plea for Americans to continue public health measures, warning of a fourth possible surge. Cases have been on the rise around the country, including a significant jump here in New Hampshire. You don't need me to tell you that. What more can or should the federal government do beyond merely pleading with Americans to behave responsibly?
Well, what we can do is provide the funding for these safety measures. And in particular, people are very anxious for kids to get back to school, and it's impacting their lives. It's impacting their livelihood, caring for children at home that have not been in school. And so we have passed this American Rescue Plan that has significant funding, $350 million here in New Hampshire for making sure we have testing. We want to get everyone vaccinated. I'm very excited about the vaccinations going on here in New Hampshire. 30% have received their first dose, so one in three, and close to 20% are fully vaccinated, one in five. We've got the numbers opening up right now in terms of 40-year-olds on Monday, 30 up on Wednesday, and tomorrow 16 and up. So all adults will be eligible to receive the vaccine. And it's critically important. What I'm excited about, Laura, is 78% of Americans now have a plan to get vaccinated. So I think that's very important. We're getting past the vaccine resistance, and what the government can do is get those shots in the arm. So already the president ramped up the manufacture and distribution of the vaccines, and now doubling the goal. He wanted to get 100 million shots in 100 days. He achieved that in 58 days. Now we're going for 200 million shots by the end of April, and we're on track to meet that goal. And that's what the federal government can do. But at the same time, encouraging people to continue to practice precautions. The masks work. We've demonstrated that. Wear your mask when you go out in public. And make sure that you are keeping your distance, that you're staying within your household as best you can,
sure,
or as often as you can.
And that's what the CDC director is saying, too.
If you want to be with people, you can do it outdoors.
Well, and hopefully the weather will start cooperating. The forecast we heard earlier from Rick Gannon was not encouraging, but I think it's going to get nicer soon.
Spring is coming. So, there's hope in the air.
So beyond sort of pleading with people, as you just did and as the CDC director did, it sounds like, Congresswoman, your role is, you know, putting the money out there so that people can get the vaccines, can reopen schools, can have access to the equipment they need. And I have a question, actually, that just came in from a listener about the stimulus bill, so I'd love to share it with you. Tim in Mount Vernon writes, I'm a selectman in a small New Hampshire town, and I recently received some guidance from the New Hampshire Municipal Association about the new stimulus bill signed by the new president. The information describes an allotment of nearly $1 billion and what every city and town could receive based on population. Tim says, it's a lot of money. Our little town of 2,700 souls could receive $240,000 if this disbursement comes to pass. Please ask the congressman if this is actually going to happen. Tim, thank you for writing. And Congresswoman, a couple questions there. First of all, this new stimulus bill did already pass, correct? And the money is kind of coming to New Hampshire at this moment.
Yes. So this will come to pass. What he's referring to, and we've been working on this for a very long time, is reimbursement to our cities and towns, both for responding to COVID, the increased expense for overtime. You know, it's hard to go back a whole year, but we were scrambling to get PPE for our first responders, for police and fire and EMTs to be safe as they went about their jobs. Many of them did contract COVID in the early days, and our goal was to keep them safe, and that was expensive for those communities. But not only the cost of responding to COVID, it's also the lost revenue, Laura. And New Hampshire is a good example of that, where we rely on the property tax. We had 16% unemployment last spring during the shutdown, and there were many people who could not afford to pay their property tax in July, and many continued through to December.
Well, and rooms and meals taxes took a hit as well. Sure.
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's what, you know, I can remember last spring, the conversations with the governor. He was frantic. He had a $500 million deficit hole in the budget from the rooms and meals tax, and we were all working on trying to get that funding for the state of New Hampshire. So that's what it's about, and I think it was important. I want to make sure we can build back better. I don't want us to struggle coming out of this pandemic that's been such a challenge for families, for workers, and you know, things like it really pulled back the curtain on these inequities, things like broadband. And this small town may be one of those examples in the western part of the state where people struggled to go to school and to work and to get their health care online if they didn't have broadband. There's funding in this bill to help with that as well.
To Tim's point, though, about, you know, our little town of 2,700 souls could receive $240,000. There has been a lot of concern, Congresswoman, I'm sure you know, between the last pandemic economic stimulus package and this most recent one, that our country's debt and deficits are just through the roof. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, says our deficit will be $2.3 trillion this year. Now, I'm old enough to remember when debt was measured in trillions, not deficits. Those are the annual counts that used to not be that big. At what point does the spending aim to help the economy, aim to help communities like Tim's, create such enormous deficits and debt that it ends up hurting the economy through inflation, you know, through all sorts of other impacts?
Well, Laura, the good news is that we consulted with numerous economists, and the vast majority of economists, this was a rare example where they were all on one page, told us to go big in this American Rescue Plan, that they feared much more that we would not sufficiently get the aid out, get the vaccines out, get the stimulus, and that overcome the unemployment, overcome the closed businesses. Right here in New Hampshire, tourism and hospitality is the number two sector of our economy, and they had a 90% drop last spring during the shutdown, and for many of them, that continues. If you talk to restaurant owners, the story that led right before we came on the air was about restaurant owners struggling. We want to make sure that we can come back very, very strong as an economy, and that's what we've been told by the economists, that the tax revenue that comes from a strong, vibrant, thriving economy will more than make up for this spending.
Well, Tim, thank you for writing in. And Congresswoman, we have to take a very short break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about pandemic economic relief. We'll look at the president's new infrastructure plan just put out yesterday, and we'll keep taking your questions. You can write them in to Congresswoman Anne McClain Custer at exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're talking with Congresswoman Anne McClain Custer today, a Democrat representing New Hampshire's 2nd District, and we're taking your questions and comments. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, or you can give us a call, 800-892-6477. And Congresswoman, before the break, we were talking about federal spending, the latest pandemic economic relief package. Speaking of spending, President Biden unveiled more yesterday with his infrastructure plan, which he calls the American Jobs Plan. I'll just summarize briefly. It includes fixing roads, ports, bridges, expanding high-speed internet access, investing in clean energy, climate change research, and there's a whole bunch more. For New Hampshire, Congresswoman, what's the most important piece of this?
I would say for us, broadband is right near the top. During COVID, we were scrambling to get families broadband access, and I want to commend the companies that we worked with that literally helped families get online so that their kids could finish school last spring and then into the fall. But it really covers the gamut. We've got funding for housing. We know we have a severe housing crunch here in New Hampshire. Rents are very, very high. We want to make sure people can afford housing. We have got renewable energy that I'm very, very excited about. I'm working in my Energy and Commerce Committee on a project about hydro energy, which is a new agreement that was reached between the hydro companies and the environmental conservation communities for rehabbing and retrofitting and removing dams. Hydro is 8% of the national renewable clean energy, and it's important here in New Hampshire.
Did you say 8%, Congresswoman? We just had a little dropout there. Did you say 8%? Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
8%. So it's almost as high as wind, much higher than solar, and is, you know, jobs. This whole package is about jobs, and that's what I'm very excited about. Also, roads and bridges and highways, that's always important. The country, U.S., ranks 13th in the world right now on infrastructure. We have not had a significant investment in infrastructure for far too long, and so I'm excited about what we can do there. And then childcare, investing, this was another thing during COVID. We obviously saw the impact. 1 in 4 women in this country have had to leave the workplace. And I'm concerned about that in terms of the impact on our economy, on families, on the livelihood of families. And I want to make sure that not only do we safely reopen the schools, but that we reopen the childcare centers that closed and invest in childcare going forward.
Well, there is a lot in this package.
It should be considered part of the infrastructure.
Well, and that's up for debate, though, and I did want to ask you that. You know, roads and bridges, broadband, most people get that as part of our infrastructure. But as you mentioned, there's money in this infrastructure plan for home-based care for the elderly and disabled Americans. Childcare, as you mentioned, $300 billion for manufacturers that one conservative economist called corporate welfare. And some more moderate Democrats and Republicans are saying this bill would be more successful if it were more focused on infrastructure. So I wonder what you think about that, Congresswoman.
Well, I think it depends how you define it. We have narrowly defined infrastructure in the past as roads and bridges and highways to get workers to their jobs and get their goods to market. But the reality of working families' lives is it goes well beyond that, that caring for the elderly family members, caring for children, this is all part of people being available to participate in the workforce. And these are the very jobs that have been so woefully underpaid. And so I think we need to address that. In terms of manufacturing, again, we are losing our global competitiveness. We need to strengthen with public investments in research and development. We're losing small to mid-sized manufacturing. And one of the issues I'm very focused on is that manufacturing is moving toward our urban areas. So there's a troublesome concentration on where the job creation is happening. I want to make sure that people have opportunities in states like New Hampshire. And what's interesting about COVID is that people were moving to New Hampshire because it's such a beautiful place to be. They felt safer here. We've done a great job in terms of keeping the numbers low and keeping people safe. And so I want to make sure that there are jobs here for people and for young people to grow up and stay here in New Hampshire. I'm glad but I think more should.
I want to ask you about that global competitiveness in just a moment. But let's go back to the listeners, Congresswoman. And Pam's calling in from Dover. Pam, thanks for calling The Exchange. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm 75. I've been living in New Hampshire all my life, and I'm on Social Security now. And I have spoken with many people that that are on Social Security, and none of us have received the stimulus. And I was wondering, you know, when would we be getting it?
I'm so glad you called, Pam, and I'm sorry you haven't gotten it yet. Can you clarify, Congresswoman, please, some of the sort of parameters around these stimulus checks? Because this is a concern, I'm sure, for many listeners.
Yep, Pam, thank you so much for calling in, and it's great to hear from you. I just learned myself this very week. I was reading in the news that the Social Security recipients will be receiving their stimulus checks now, shortly, within the next week or two. And if you don't get it, please call Representative Pappas or call my office, 603-226-1002. We're happy to help you track that down. I think the original checks went out or were deposited, the most immediate payments, and she's referring to the $1,400 stimulus payments in the American Rescue Plan. They were deposited immediately to people who pay federal taxes, and had the IRS had their bank information for the deposit. And then now they're getting to the Social Security recipients who receive funds from the government, but perhaps don't pay in with taxes. And those funds, the $1,400 deposits are coming to those Social Security recipients.
I see. That's the next iteration then. Okay. Yep. Well, I'm glad you called, Pam, because that does need to be clarified. On what you said a moment ago, Congresswoman, about manufacturing here in the U.S., we're losing our global competitiveness, you said. Some Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill have said that raising corporate taxes to pay for this infrastructure package of the president's could, in fact, hurt American global competitiveness as well. So how concerned are you about raising corporate taxes to fund this thing?
Well, keep in mind, we're just trying to rebalance from the dramatic tax drop of the Trump years, both individuals and corporations. It fell all the way down to 8%, the corporate tax rate. And the truth of the matter that we've learned many, many corporations, including huge corporations like Amazon or Google, or don't pay any taxes whatsoever at all. And so that's my biggest concern. I want to level the playing field. And what's happening right now, our corporate tax revenue is very low, at an all-time low, the lowest that it's been since World War II. And the incentives remain to ship jobs overseas. That's a big concern that I've always had. I ran on that from the beginning. I want to make sure that people have an incentive to build and manufacture right here in the United States. And so what the Biden reform plan aims to do is to make U.S. companies more competitive, level the playing field, reform the international tax system so that the corporations don't have an incentive to ship jobs overseas. And even if this bill is passed into law and we do raise the corporate tax rate, it will still be the lowest that we've had since World War II. So I think when it comes to U.S. corporations, they can afford to pay their fair share. And by the way, this infrastructure paid by federal tax dollars benefits those corporations. You've talked about that. Roads and bridges and highways and airports and ports and trains. All of this is benefiting our economy, and those companies benefit from it, and I think they can pay their fair share.
I have one more question about this infrastructure bill, and recognizing that it's new, it was just presented yesterday, it still has to go through the whole process. And then I have some more emails I'd love to share with you, Congresswoman. I want to remind listeners, Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. So you can put your questions there, or you can call like Pam did. It's 800-892-6477. One more question on this infrastructure bill. It focuses on so-called green jobs, green energy. Here in New Hampshire, as you know, there's a lot of concern about climate change's impact on our state. And some environmental groups, a fair number of them, have said the president's infrastructure plan falls far short when it comes to climate. You've got some people on one side saying this is too big, he's packed too much in it, it's too expensive. But some of the climate groups are saying it's not nearly enough. And I wonder what your view is on this. Is there enough toward reducing greenhouse gases and, not letting global temperatures spike too much?
Sure. And thank you for bringing that up. This is a major priority of mine, serving, as I said, on the Energy Subcommittee of the Energy and Commerce Committee. And these are the hearings that we're having right now about this American Jobs Plan, about some people refer to it as the American Recovery Plan, Building Back Better After COVID. I think that we're going to hear more in our committee, and I believe that this bill will change. So what you're talking about is what the president presented yesterday in a major speech in Pittsburgh. As this bill comes forward, we will have plenty of opportunity in our committee. I mentioned, for example, about the hydro energy. I want to make sure that that's included in the bill. There are wind energy projects off the coast of New England that are extremely important to our region and to controlling greenhouse gas and lowering carbon levels and saving our planet. I want the win-win-win. I want to create jobs. I want to invest in renewable energy, and I want to save the planet. And that's where I think we're likely to end up, is a balanced approach. Keep in mind that we do have very tight margins. The Democratic House and the Democratic Senate is a 50-50 tie, with Kamala Harris casting the deciding vote. And so we are going to need to work with our colleagues across the aisle and find that balance. But
well, I think that's an important point.
I think there is a solution there.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, just because the president puts it out there doesn't make it so. There's a long process in the House and in the Senate of hearings and changes and so forth. So I understand what you're saying there. We did get some emails, actually, about your work on energy issues. Barbara in Bradford wrote, "Thank you, Representative Custer, for co-sponsoring the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act last session. Will you be co-sponsoring it again this year? Will you be talking to other legislators about it and trying to get their support?" Marge also wrote, "What energy bills are you working on? Do any of them include a price on carbon so we can start putting a price on pollution?" Without going into too much detail, Congresswoman, what is that Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act that Barbara writes about?
Right. Well, and the answer is yes. Of course, I will co-sponsor again. What this topic is about, and it's very interesting, economists have really been evolving and getting on board to this concept of putting a price on carbon, a price on the pollution that is causing global warming and causing all these weather and climate impacts that we're having to contend with. And I believe the answer is yes. If, again, going back to hospitality and tourism in New Hampshire, I created and I'm the co-chair of the bipartisan Congressional Ski and Snow Sports Caucus. And so I talk a lot with our ski area operators, with the scientists that are studying climate and studying the changes to our economy because of it. We have 10 fewer days of snowmaking weather here in New Hampshire than when I was a girl. That's a big impact.
And
they come
big
in December. They come in December, which is typically the Christmas holiday is the critical time for ski areas to raise revenue. And imagine the impact that has on hospitality and tourism, again, number two in our economy.
So to answer Barbara's question,
snowmobiling. So it's important.
I spent a fair bit of time up north myself this winter, so I hear you really enjoying the winter. You will be co-sponsoring this again, and it sounds like it's like a carbon, it includes a carbon fee or a carbon tax, some kind of price on carbon. That's fundamentally there.
A price on carbon that would then, again, getting back to level the playing field. And think of it this way. For years, the federal government has subsidized what you might call carbon polluting industries, coal, oil. And New Hampshire has not benefited from that, by the way. We don't have those jobs. What the jobs that we have, maybe electric distribution, certainly Eversource and other companies up here. But our what we can do is create more diversified, whether it's hydro, wind, offshore wind, as I mentioned, is a big win-win-win for New England. Solar, many people putting solar on their rooftops, businesses putting solar on their rooftops. So all of these can come together and help us. And it's a question of the federal government finding the right incentives in the tax code to really honestly save the planet.
Well, Barbara and Marge, thank you for writing in. Clearly, that's a big topic on the agenda. We are going to take another very short break. When we come back, Congresswoman, I want to ask you about voting and immigration and a couple more questions as well. You can keep your questions coming in to listeners. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. It's your chance to talk with 2nd District Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer. Once again, it's exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Catch up on all the Granite State headlines you might have missed. That's Friday morning, live at 9, with host Peter Biello. Today, we're talking with Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer, a Democrat representing New Hampshire's 2nd District. And listeners, it's been great to hear from you. Keep your questions coming in. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 800-892-6477. And Congresswoman Joel wrote to us asking about the Postal Service. He says the Constitution gives Congress the power to establish post offices. Joel asks, doesn't this imply that post offices should be run for public benefit, not as private businesses? Why then is the U.S. Postal Service not being provided with sufficient funding to deliver mail in a timely fashion? What can be done, Joel asks, to restore public faith in the U.S. Postal Service? Joel, thank you very much. Go ahead, Congresswoman.
Joel, thank you so much for writing in. And the number one thing that can happen is a new postmaster, because I think a lot of people have lost confidence in his report that he's going to delay mail and lengthen the time that packages are delivered. There's a problem here that relates to a decision that was made about Postal Service retirement. And it's an accounting issue that they insisted that the Postal Service, unlike other private companies, UPS or FedEx, that the Postal Service count the retirement savings in their current budget. And it makes it look as though the Postal Service is not successful. I'm a big fan of the Postal Service. I think it's incredible. And one thing that most viewers don't know about is that the Postal Service often delivers what we call the last mile, the local delivery of FedEx packages, for example. I visited the I was with the mail handlers and visited their plant down in Manchester during the holidays. And I was so surprised to see these big FedEx boxes. And what they were about was that FedEx brings it there and then they deliver it to the home. And so they provide a tremendous service. We should absolutely be certain to fund the Postal Service. And we should, you know, charge the going rates so that they can be successful in competing. But I think they do very, very well. And they go places that these larger carriers are not willing to go. If I go to my small towns in the North Country or the western part of the state, they know that they can rely on the Postal Service. And I think that's important for everyone.
Joel, thank you for writing. I want to ask you about voting, Congresswoman. New Hampshire Secretary of State Bill Gardner, as you know, is pretty upset about what's called the For the People Act of 2021. Gardner calls it, I'm just going to quote here, an egregious overreach of federal authority that flagrantly ignores or diminishes the provisions of our state constitution, including early voting, how ballots are counted, when results are declared. That's just a little bit of the criticism that Secretary Gardner had for this bill. What's your response, Congresswoman?
Well, needless to say, I disagree. And what the For the People Act is all about, and by the way, strong support, Republicans, Democrats, independents across the board, to get dark money out of politics, to protect access to the ballot. And if you look at the 2020 election. And it's, again, ironic because of COVID. But look at the experience we had with early voting that we had never had here in New Hampshire, how successful that was. With mail-in voting, how successful that was. And by the way, Republicans and Democrats, 75 million Republicans voted in this country. Joe Biden won the election lawfully by many millions. But the fact is, Republicans and Democrats across this country turned out to vote, even in the midst of a very dangerous pandemic. And it was because we made voting easier for people. I am on the side of making voting easier for people. And if the Secretary of State is not, he has his opinion. I want to make sure everyone has access to the ballot. Early voting, vote by mail, same day registration. We've shown that to work here in New Hampshire. Let's share that with the rest of the country. And all we have to do is look at Georgia. Just in the last month, Georgia has passed a number of bills in their state legislature to suppress the vote. I feel that voters should choose politicians. Politicians should not choose which voters are eligible. And
so
we should do everything we can to count every vote.
Isn't this more up to the states, though? You know, traditionally, my understanding is states and localities were in charge of elections.
And they will continue to be, but we're setting federal standards about what is appropriate in terms of access to the ballot box.
Okay. Well, we will set that aside for now. I know NHPR's Josh Rogers has done some reporting on this topic. So if listeners want to learn more, go to our website, nhpr.org, and Josh's story is right there. I did want to ask you a little bit about immigration, Congresswoman. This has definitely made headlines. In 2018, you visited the U.S.-Mexico border. You described scenes of parents and children being torn apart by immigration officials, and you criticized the Trump administration policy at the time. What we're seeing now, though, is thousands of unaccompanied minors being held in cramped quarters again in U.S. custody. The media has started to release, you know, photos and videos of this. They look pretty disturbing. How satisfied are you with the Biden administration's approach to this situation at the border?
Well, we did get a briefing yesterday from the White House. Our former colleague, Javier Becerra, who's now the Secretary of Health and Human Services. We have the Secretary of Department of Homeland Security. And we had a number of challenging questions as to the situation down at the border. What is happening is a confluence of many factors. We know this time of year there is a surge in migration from along our southern border, but we also have the situation of COVID-19 to deal with. And so what their goal, and I believe that they're putting into place policies that will ensure this, is to move these young migrant children through this process just as quickly as possible. The good news is that 80% of the children do have family members to be reunited with, and that's the process that we need to speed up, so that they're there for under 72 hours so that they can get to those family members just as quickly as they can. And we want to make sure that they're safe while they're waiting to get reunited. And I agree with you, it does look very crowded, 4,000 children coming across the border in a relatively short period of time is a lot to manage. What they've done as an emergency step is they're going to open up a military base so that they can spread the kids out a little bit more. And what we need is to get a surge in personnel to the border. And in particular, it was interesting, it's not so much border officials and officers that we need, it's actually social workers for making the phone calls and making the determination that this is a relative that is safe for the child to be released to.
In many
cases, it's a parent or a sibling, but we want to make sure that it's a safe place for them to go.
You said at the hearing on this, there were a number of challenging questions. What type of challenges did you put forward to Homeland Security on this?
It was a briefing, and it was about a group of my colleagues had been to the border over the weekend. Hopefully I'll get a chance to go back down as well. And they were pleased with what they had seen. I think the biggest difference that you'll see, the Trump administration had a very punitive approach, and they were separating, as you know, what I was most disturbed by, separating children and parents. I was talking to nursing mothers whose babies had been taken from them by the Trump administration. That's not the approach of the Biden administration. And we are doing our best to get these children to families, their unaccompanied minors, getting them as quickly as possible to be reunited with their relatives.
Sure, as you said. I guess I was just wondering what challenges came up in that hearing. That's what I was wondering about.
Yeah, the challenges that we're talking about of having so many people and COVID, really, how do you keep people safe in the environment of COVID? When, you know, these facilities are overcrowded right now. And so we were talking with them, how quickly can they get these kids out of those border facilities into, and that's when they brought up bringing, using the Department of Defense military base, where people can keep their distance and we won't have to be as concerned about spreading COVID.
Well, one more question for you, Congresswoman, and it's a question that so many listeners ask us every time we talk to you and Senator Shaheen and Congressman Pappas and Senator Hassan. It has to do with prescription drug costs. We always hear about this from listeners, that they are still struggling with the high cost of prescription drugs in this country. My question for you is a broad one. Why does this remain such a stubborn problem? So many people care about this. We've been talking about it forever, and it doesn't seem to change.
Well, I agree with the frustration. You know, we have a situation in the United States where research and development of new medication is very expensive, and we have tremendous breakthroughs. And just look at, we have three vaccines in under a year. We've got a fourth on the way. It's extraordinary. There's no country in the world that does this as well as we do. But the challenge is those costs get passed on to consumers. And for many people, the cost of medication is just too high, or particular medications are too high. So we have made some progress. Certainly generics made a big difference. And that was a policy to share the patents after a period of time so that people could have access to lower cost medication. Certainly under the Affordable Care Act, there were ways to bring down the cost of medication and to make sure that medication is covered by your health insurance. That was part of the issue for many people. They didn't have coverage, and now more and more people do have that. So we're going to continue to work on it. There are still steps that can be done in terms of bulk purchasing, in terms of making sure that people get the best price. Things to investigate that didn't get very far in the Trump administration, but I think we will continue to look at as an alternative. We have people from New Hampshire that go to Canada or buy medication from Canada. Can we get a better price if we use an international price as a
That's controversial. We could talk about that for a whole hour because drug companies can't stand that.
All hearings that we're having in our health subcommittee of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and I expect we will see progress on drug pricing coming in the Biden administration. But I share the frustration.
Well, you serve on a task force aimed at what's called holistic approaches toward addiction and mental health treatment, two huge issues here in the Granite State. If I could ask you to be very brief, Congresswoman, because it is interesting, but we're running close to the end. What does that mean, holistic approaches to addiction and mental health treatment?
So what this is about, I've had a bipartisan opioid task force. I've now merged that, and we're calling it the Bipartisan Addiction and Mental Health Task Force with my Republican and Democratic colleagues. And we're having our first roundtable coming up in April about the impact of COVID-19. But it's bringing together these co-occurring illnesses. Many, many people suffering from substance use disorder are also suffering from depression, anxiety, trauma. And what we have found is that the most successful treatment is to treat the co-occurring illness, the mental health and the addiction together. And this is a big issue that I'm pursuing in my committee about providing services during incarceration and in our communities so that we can overcome the other big pandemic, which is the pandemic of addiction that we were dealing with before COVID-19. We also have a hearing coming up on our bipartisan task force to end sexual violence. And again, working in a bipartisan way to address trauma, depression, anxiety that may lead to addiction or other difficult behaviors.
Well, Congresswoman, during the pandemic, many Granite Staters told us they found refuge in the great outdoors, and that did help at least deal with some of the anxiety around the pandemic. Where have you gone outside, Congresswoman, to feel better?
Well, everywhere around home, walking every single day, wonderful trails. I love that.
Trails
and
Hopkinton.
Then getting up north a lot, getting skiing in at Sunapee and up at Wildcat, and just getting outdoors, I think, has been the best thing. It's, skiing has been very safe and a wonderful release for me, and I hope others have gotten outdoors and enjoyed our beautiful state.
Well, Congresswoman Custer, thank you very much for giving us an hour of your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Laura. Always great to be with you. Stay safe. Get your vaccine, everyone.
That's Anne McLean Custer. She's a Democratic representative from New Hampshire's 2nd District. Today's show was produced by Exchange senior producer Ellen Grimm.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.